But gray tendencies are not to be judged by contemporary experience alone, still less by an inherited habit of thought from the past. We have to strike a curve in to find out the future probable development of that curve. It is worthless merely to strike a tangent from the particular moment in which we live if you had hazarded such guesses, even as little as 50 years ago, as 50 that by 1929 the United States would be under prohibition, 2 that women would be sitting in the English House of Commons, 3 that Russia would be organized as an experiment in communism under a clique of Jews. The suggestions would have sounded mad, yet all these things have come to pass, and an observer of general tendencies in the course of the 19th century might have observed the beginnings of the forces which were to lead to such widespread changes. What forces are present today making for a moral alliance between the rising paganism of the white man and the age-long paganism of the black, brown and yellow man? They are two, and they are sufficiently remarkable. There is, in the first place, the sympathy between any one paganism and another, for all forms of paganism have in common the principle that man is sufficient to himself, and all have in common the negation of an absolute divine authority acting through revelation. They also have all in common the indulgence of human passion, and the practical permission of excess in it, whether in the passions of the appetite, or of anger, or of any other driving power in natural man. In the second place, there is propinquity. We are today mixed up with the old outer world as the classic paganism of our forefathers never was. The paganism of the Mediterranean basin, from which all our culture springs, was not originally affected very much by the paganisms of Asia. By the paganism of the black races it was affected hardly at all, not because they would not have had some natural affinity with any other paganism, but because there was little physical contact between them. Today such opportunity is universal, and is increasing in effect. Today the barrier, the only effective barrier, against such infiltration of pagan ideas from races other than our own, is a strong anti-pagan moral system and creed, and there is none such outside the Catholic Church. If anyone doubt the menace of which I speak, let him know the nature of the degradation which has already, so recently and rapidly, come over our art. It is not the most important side of the affair, but it is the most easily discoverable, and therefore I mention it before the others. Thus, in our popular music the thing is glaring. The modern revolution in that art is a direct introduction of a force deriving from African paganism. There is a strong though indirect and veiled corresponding influence in architecture, coming, not indeed from Africa, where paganism was too debased to have any architecture at all, but from the same spiritual roots as nourished the monstrous moles of the ancient East. In this perversion the Prussians have been pioneers, the Bavarians after them, and the French are now following suit. England, happily for herself, lags behind. In Italy, with its strong Catholic culture, there is now a powerful reaction towards the ancestral beauty of European things as towards order in all its forms. But take Europe as a whole, and it is suffering heavily, and perhaps increasingly, in its external forms of art, not only architectural but pictorial, from the pagan influence of Asia. In sculpture this repulsive innovation is notorious. But by far the most profound effect of what I will call the pagan alliance appears in what lies at the root of everything, to wit, philosophy. Whether it be in the form of religious error, or in the commoner form of negation which is the essential of the Buddhist business, what it is plainer to call, in Christian terms, atheism, the influence of these ancient alien paganisms is upon us everywhere. At the same time we are growing more and more to respect the cultures arisen from those exterior paganisms. Our modern neo-pagans of European stock have welcomed this fraternization as a good thing. This welcome springs in part from their brotherhood of the world business, but much more is it a response of like to like. It is not a good thing, it is a very bad thing, is this new respect for the non-Christian and anti-Christian cultures outside Europe. Insofar as it progresses it will inevitably breed, as it has already bred in so many, a contempt of Christian tradition and philosophy, as being things at once old-fashioned and puerile. There is more than one prominent European writer professing not only close acquaintance with, but reverence for, the Buddhist negation of God and of personal immortality. At the other extreme you have the respect for the pagan ruthlessness and the pagan doctrine of right by conquest. There is no doubt that a powerful accelerator to this tendency was the sudden modern development of Japan. When the Japanese army defeated the Russian 20-odd years ago, it was a turning point in the history of our culture. When the government of Great Britain took the step of allying itself openly with this new force, a policy which preceded that victory, it was a moral turning point even more serious. The thing has not yet gone so far as to become an immediate menace. The intercommunion between the new paganism of Europeans and the very ancient paganism of other races is as yet only faintly sketched out, but it is advancing. I cannot but believe that in another generation it will be powerful, apparent to all. There remains, apart from the old paganism of Asia and Africa, another indirect supporter of neo-paganism, a supporter which indeed hates all paganism but hates the Catholic Church much more, a factor of whose now increasing importance the masses of Europe are not as yet aware. I mean the Mohammedan religion, Islam. Islam presents a totally different problem from that attached to any other religious body opposed to Catholicism. To understand it, we must appreciate its origins, character and recent fate. Only then can we further appreciate its possible or probable future relations with enemies of the Catholic effort throughout the world. How did Islam arise? It was not, as our popular historical textbooks would have it, a new religion. It was a direct derivative from the Catholic Church. It was essentially, in its origin, a heresy, like Arianism or Albigensians. When the man who produced it, and it is more the creation of one man than any other false religion we know, was young, the whole of the world which he knew, the world speaking Greek in the eastern half and Latin in the western, the only civilized world with which he and his people had come in contact, was Catholic. It was still, though in process of transformation, the Christian Roman Empire, stretching from the English Channel to the borders of his own desert. The Arabs of whom he came and among whom he lived were pagan, but such high a religious influence as could touch them, and as they came in contact with through commerce and raiding, was Catholic, with a certain admixture of Jewish communities. Catholicism had thus distinctly affected these few pagans living upon the fringes of the empire. Now what Muhammad did was this. He took over the principal doctrines of the Catholic Church: one personal God, creator of all things, the immortality of the soul, an eternity of misery or blessedness, and no small part of Christian morals as well. All that was the atmosphere of the only civilization which had influence upon him or his. But at the same time he attempted an extreme simplification. Many another heresiarch has done this, throwing overboard such and such too profound doctrines, and appealing to the less intelligent by getting rid of mysteries through a crude denial of them. But Muhammad simplified much more than did, say, Pelagius or even Arius. He turned our Lord into a mere prophet, though the greatest of the prophets, Our Lady whom he greatly revered, and whom his followers still revere, he turned into no more than the mother of so great a prophet. He cut out the Eucharist altogether, and what was most difficult to follow in the matter of the resurrection, he abolished all idea of priesthood. Most important of all, he declared for social equality among all those who should be true believers after his fashion. With the energy of his personality behind that highly simplified, burning enthusiasm, he first inflamed his own few desert folk, and they in turn proceeded to impose their new enthusiasm very rapidly over vast areas of what had been until then a Catholic civilization. And their chief allies in this sweeping revolution were politically the doctrine of equality, and spiritually the doctrine of simplicity. Everybody troubled by the mysteries of Catholicism tended to join them, so did every slave or debtor who was oppressed by the complexity of a higher civilization. The new enthusiasm charged under arms over about half of the Catholic world. There was a moment after it had started out on its conquest when it looked as though it was going to transform and degrade all our Christian culture. But our civilization was saved at last, though half the Mediterranean was lost. For centuries the struggle between Islam and the Catholic Church continued. It had varying fortunes, but for something like 1,000 years the issue still remained doubtful. It was not till nearly the year 1700, the great conquests of Islam having begun long before 700, that Christian culture seemed for a time to be definitely the master. During the 18th and 19th centuries the Mohammedan world fell under a kind of palsy. It could not catch up with our rapidly advancing physical science. Its shipping and armament and all means of communication and administration went backwards while ours advanced. At last, by the end of the 19th century, more than 9/10 of the Mahometan population of the world, from India and the Pacific to the Atlantic, had fallen under the government of nominally Christian nations, especially of England and France. On this account, our generation came to think of Islam as something naturally subject to ourselves. We no longer regarded it as a rival to our own culture. We thought of its religion as a sort of fossilized thing about which we need not trouble. That was almost certainly a mistake. We shall almost certainly have to reckon with Islam in the near future. Perhaps if we lose our faith, it will rise. For after this subjugation of the Islamic culture by the nominally Christian had already been achieved, the political conquerors of that culture began to notice two disquieting features about it. The first was that its spiritual foundation proved immovable. The second that its area of occupation did not recede, but on the contrary slowly expanded. Islam would not look at any Christian missionary effort. The so-called Christian governments, in contact with it, it spiritually despised. The ardent and sincere Christian missionaries were received usually with courtesy, sometimes with fierce attack, but were never allowed to affect Islam. I think it true to say that Islam is the only spiritual force on earth which Catholicism has found an impregnable fortress. Its votaries are the one religious body conversions from which are insignificant. This granite permanence is a most striking thing, and worthy of serious consideration by all those who meditate upon the spiritual, and, consequently, the social, future of the world. And what is true of the spiritual side of Islam is true of the geographical. Mahometan rulers have had to give up Christian provinces formerly under their control, especially in the Balkans. But the area of Mahometan practice has not shrunk. All that wide belt from the islands of the Pacific to Morocco, and from Central Asia to the Sahara Desert and south of it, not only remains intact but slightly expands. Islam is appreciably spreading its influence further and further into tropical Africa. Now that state of affairs creates a very important subject of study for those who interest themselves in the future of religious influence upon mankind. The political control of Islam by Europe cannot continue indefinitely, it is already shaken. Meanwhile, the spiritual independence of Islam upon which everything depends is as strong as, or stronger than, ever. What affinities or support does this threat of Islam promise to the new enemies of Catholic tradition? It will sound even more fantastic to suggest that Islam should have effect here than to suggest that Asiatic paganism should. Even those who are directly in contact with the great Mahometan civilization and who are impressed, as all such must be, by its strength and apparently invincible resistance to conversion, do not yet conceive of its having any direct effect upon Christendom. There are a few indeed who have envisaged something of the kind, but what they had to say was said before the Great War, was confined to individuals either isolated or eccentric, and produced no lasting impression upon either the French or the English, the only two European countries closely connected, as governing powers, with the Mahometan. To the New World the problem is quite unfamiliar. It touches Mahometanism nowhere save very slightly in the Philippines. Nevertheless, I will maintain that this very powerful, distorted simplification of Catholic doctrine, for that is what Mahometanism is, may be of high effect in the near future upon Christendom, and that, acting as a competitive religion, it is not to be despised. No considerable number of conversions to Mahometanism from Christendom is probable. I do not say that such a movement would not be possible, for anything is possible in the near future, seeing the welter into which Christian civilization has fallen. But I think it improbable, and even highly improbable, because Mahometanism advances in herd or mob fashion. It does not proceed, as the Catholic religion does, by individual conversions, but by colonization and group movement. But there are other effects which a great anti-Catholic force in the culture based upon it can have upon anti-Catholic forces within our own boundaries. In the first place, it can act by example. To every man attempting to defend the old Christian culture by prophesying disaster if its main tenets be abandoned, Mahometanism can be presented as a practical answer. You say that monogamy is necessary to happy human life, and that the practice of polygamy, or of divorce, which is but a modified form of polygamy, is fatal to the state. You are proved wrong by the example of Mohammedanism. Or again, you say that without priests and without sacraments and without all the apparatus of your religion, down to the use of visible images, religion may not survive. Islam is there to give you the lie. Its religion is intense, its spiritual life permanent, yet it has constantly repudiated all these things. It is violently anti-sacramental, it has no priesthood, it wages fierce war on all symbols and the use of worship. This example may, in the near future, be of great effect. Remember that our Christian civilization is in peril of complete breakdown. An enemy would say that it was living upon its past, and certainly those who steadfastly hold its ancient Catholic doctrines stand today on guard, as it were, in a state of siege. They are a minority both in power and in numbers. Upon such a state of affairs, a steadfast, permanent, convinced, simple philosophy and rule of life, intensely adhered to, and close at hand, may, now that the various sections of the world are so much interpenetrating one and the other, be of effect. The effect may ultimately be enhanced in the near future by a political change. We must remember that the subjection of the Mohammedan, a purely political subjection, was accomplished by nothing more subtle or enduring than a superiority in weapons and mechanical invention. We must further remember that this superiority dates from a very short time ago. Old people with whom I have myself spoken as a child could remember the time when the Algerian pirates were seen in the Mediterranean and were still in danger along its southern shores. In my own youth, the decaying power of Islam, for it was still decaying in the Near East, was a strong menace to the peace of Europe. Those old people of whom I speak had grandparents in whose times Islam was still able to menace the West. The Turks besieged Vienna and nearly took it, less than a century before the American Declaration of Independence. Islam was then our superior, especially in military art. There is no reason why its recent inferiority in mechanical construction, whether military or civilian, should continue indefinitely. Even a slight accession of material power would make the further control of Islam by an alien culture difficult. A little more and there will cease that which our time has taken for granted, the physical domination of Islam by the disintegrated Christendom we know. That the new arrival called neo-paganism will increase seems assured. That it will find support, positive from the older paganism, negative from Islam as a fellow opponent of Catholicism, is possible or probable, though the modes of such support are not apparent today. But will it long remain as the main opposition when it shall have come to maturity? Or will it give way to some new religion, with definite tenets and an organization of its own? Is there any appearance as yet of such a development? That is what we may next examine, and we must begin by looking at one or two typical bodies of the sort already in existence in order to decide whether they threatened to grow, or point to what might succeed them. Outside the Catholic Church, we say, what was once Christendom is rapidly becoming pagan, pagan after a new fashion, but still pagan. It is falling into the mood that man is sufficient to himself, and all the consequences of that mood will follow under a general color of despair. But will this mood, after a first trial, be supplanted by a new religion sufficiently universal, organized and strong to challenge the Catholic Church? At present there is no sign of such a thing. None is present among the new arrivals. But may not some such force soon arise? It is very probable. It is not certain. It is probable, because man can with difficulty persist in mere ideas or abstractions. He can with difficulty live on such thin food. He needs the meat of doctrine defined, of a moral code also defined and with instances. He needs the institutions of a ritual and of all the external framework of worship. Moreover, man corporate demands answers to the great questions which face him, the problems of his own origin, nature and destiny. Man as an individual can decide them to be insoluble and lead his life not easily under the burden of that decision. But man in society does not repose in such negations. Therefore is the production of a new positive religion with a special character of its own, a ritual, a doctrine probable. But it is not certain, for we know that, as a fact, great societies have long persisted content with a social scheme in which conventions take the place of doctrine and in which no defined philosophy clothed with external ritual and supported by organization is universal or even common. And when we consider the present situation, we do not discover anything as yet from which, as from a seed, this new religion could spring. it would seem, to begin with, that there will be no resurrection of the Protestant sects. Not so long ago these were actual religions, and in particular Calvinism, with its fierce logic, iron conviction and completeness of structure, all informed with the French character of its creator, more loosely defined, but, still, organized and individual, heretical or schismatical bodies existed side by side with Calvinism. One could discover in each of these an ethic of its own, and, for all the Protestant ones combined, a fairly defined Protestant ethic or tone of mind. Meanwhile, the Greek Church nursed an antagonism rather political than doctrinal and was also a powerful adverse force. But today these forces seem to have passed beyond the possibility of resurrection. Even the political strength of the Greek Church has been put out of action permanently by the effects of the Great War and Revolution, with a gang of international adventurers replacing the old power of the Tsardom and presiding over the ruin they have made. I do not mean to deny that the strong evangelical spirit of Protestantism, and particularly of Calvinism, does not survive and is not an opponent, but when one is speaking of its resurrection as a religion for the future, one must consider doctrine, and its doctrine has so thoroughly dissolved in the last 50 years that its re-establishment is hardly conceivable. It is debatable, as I have said, whether this change is one for the worse or the better. On that point we may delay for a moment. In one sense, the power to hold any transcendental doctrine shows the soul to be still awake and therefore capable of achieving true transcendental doctrine, while those who lose the sense of the supernatural will be more difficult of approach. On the other hand, with the loss of doctrine has gone the loss of support and framework of what opposed us. For instance, a Calvinist of the old school, with his passionately held dogma of salvation by faith, had for the ornament and ritual of the Catholic Church a correspondingly fierce hatred. His son today feels for such things indifference at the best or contempt at the worst, sometimes even admiration of adventitious beauty in Catholic rite and image. At any rate, whether this great change, the decay of the old Protestant bodies, be good or evil, it is an undoubted historical fact of our day. In Britain, as in Germany and the United States, the old catechisms, and what were in their odd way quasi-creeds, have disappeared and we shall surely not hear of them again. Where else may the seed of a new religion, which shall grow to be the future archenemy of the Catholic Church, be sought? We are surrounded by many novel experiments in worship and doctrine, but in none of them, not even in the spiritualist, which would seem the strongest in structure, does there appear a vitality sufficient to produce any universal growth. We find no such vitality in what may be called the experiments in subjectivism. Their name is legion. Half a dozen have cropped up within the later part of my own lifetime, and no doubt another dozen or more will crop up within the same length of time in the immediate future. It was only the other day that I came across the sect of deep breathers. In a sense, the petty experiments thus based on what is called subjectivism are always with us, because almost any statement of religious experience through the individual, and that experience treated as a full authority without reference to the church or any other form of authority, is subjectivism. Every revivalist meeting is an example of subjectivism. So is every book claiming to discover the truth through personal emotion. But the subjective sects of this sort are swarming today with an especial vigor that merits attention if we are seeking for the possible signs of a new religion. At least, they are swarming in the English-speaking world. There is no space to discuss the origins of these things, it must be sufficient to mention them. All ultimately derive from the protest against the authority of the Church at the Reformation. Since the authority of the Church was denied, some other authority had to be accepted. The parallel authority of Holy Scripture was put forward. Then came the obvious difficulty, that, since there was no external authoritative church, there was no one to tell you what Holy Scripture meant, and you were thrown back on the interpretation which each individual might make of any passage in the Bible, or its general sense. For instance, to take the leading example, the individual had to decide for himself what was meant by the words of consecration. But the modern extension of the thing has gone far beyond such comparatively orthodox limits as trusting to the authority of Holy Scripture, even under private interpretation. It has taken the form of basing religion upon individual feelings. Men and women say, "This is true, because it is true to me. I have felt this, and therefore I know it to be true." Of these subjective sects, the most curious, though not the most powerful at the present moment, is the strange system called Christian Science. No doubt tomorrow another will succeed it, and after that yet another, but today it is Christian Science which stands out most prominently as the type of a subjective sect. Its votaries, of course, will tell us of much that it includes besides its most striking tenet, but that most striking tenet is sufficient to characterize it. The faithful of the sect are asked to regard the individual mental attitude towards evil, and especially physical evil, as a purely subjective phenomenon. Persuade yourself that it is not there, and it is not there, hence powers of healing and all the rest of it. Now these counter-religions, opponents to and, in their little way, rivals of the Catholic Church, have two characteristics apparently contradictory but not really so. One is the permanence of the phenomenon, the other is the ephemeral quality of individual instances. They are always cropping up, especially today, but they are also perpetually disappearing after a short life. I would like to concentrate upon the second characteristic, to show why I do not regard any one of these counter-religions of the subjective sort as a serious menace to Catholicism. The sectarian of these vagaries is often intense and always sincere. Based as her sometimes his mood is upon personal enthusiasm and personal spiritual experiences, it brooks no contradiction. But it does not last, because it makes no appeal to that fundamental necessity of the human reason for external proof. I may be told that it does so in the particular case of Christian Science which appeals to actual cures, but there is not sufficient volume and persistence of such cures. Moreover, the claim made is at issue with the common sense of mankind. It is here that the various forms of subjective religion show themselves so much weaker than spiritualism, for spiritualism, as we shall see, bases itself on controllable positive proof. Amid a mass of fraud there is a certain residue of ascertainable evidence, and though much of that evidence may be shaken there is a remainder which cannot be denied. Spiritualism appeals to something which the human race has always demanded, to wit, external evidence verifiable by a number of independent means. Your purely subjective religion does not appeal to such evidence. It appeals to intensity of enthusiasm, and to little more. Hence its lack of substance, its probable lack of endurance. Here it may be objected, if you say that this or that sect, based on such mere emotions and wholly subjective in character, cannot form the seed of an organized universal religion, what about the Catholic Church, which herself arose from such a beginning of enthusiasm and delusion? The parallel is wholly false. Nothing is commoner than for those who are ill acquainted with the early history of the Catholic Church and of the society in which it arose, to explain the origin of Catholicism in these terms. They put it forward as a subjective religion, confirmed by some marvelous cures which were ill and a host of imaginary events which men only accepted because they were in an abnormal state of mind. But has Catholicism really been like this in its origins? It would never have survived. It survived because it appealed also to the general sense of mankind, because it fitted in with what mankind knew of itself and its needs, and of what it lacked to satisfy such needs, also because it confirmed itself every day in the lives of those subjected to it, because, of the wonders put forward, the greatest of all the resurrection was reluctantly witnessed to by opponents, but most of all because it maintained unity. The Catholic Church was from her origin a thing, not a theory. She was a society informing the individual, and not a mass of individuals forming a society. From her very beginning she tracked down heresy and expelled it. She is a kingdom. Subjective religion is a private whim. Though it must continue an unceasing form of error so long as men refuse authority and are strongly subject to religious emotion, it will never build up a rival church. A is a general tendency, especially while it still inherits the general ethic of its Protestant origins 300 years old. It is an influence hostile to Catholicism, but its various products have not the stuff of permanence in them. They have not in them a sufficient correspondence with reality to create any one formidable opponent. Spiritualism has such correspondence with real objective phenomena. What of spiritualism? When I examine spiritualism from the outside, I notice certain characteristics about it which are very remarkable. In the first place, there is a positiveness, an unquestioning and sober conviction which is quite different from the hysteria of the sects and which it is of the highest interest to note and analyze. This conviction is not of the nature of faith, properly so called. Faith is a virtue, a grace, and an act of the will. The essential of faith is an acceptation, upon authority, of things unseen. That is a refusal by the will to admit the opposite of a proposition, although experimental proof be lacking. But spiritualism holds its convictions upon sensible, or supposedly sensible, experience, that is, upon experimental proof. Now that is a new note altogether in the story of modern religions. The Presbyterian, the Lutheran, the Baptist and the rest did not say that they held their tenets through a direct personal experience of the senses. Neither Zwingli nor any other heresiarch claimed that they had seen or heard the things which they believed. On the contrary, apart from their novel doctrines, they retained a great mass of the ancient Catholic dogmas such as the Incarnation, the Trinity, etc., which of their essence are transcendental and cannot be witnessed to by the senses. But spiritualism says, I have physical evidence of those things hitherto called supernatural, and it is upon that physical evidence I base myself, not upon an internal emotion or religious experience as does the typical Protestant sectarian today, nor on authority as does every Catholic. I think we ought to recognize how strong a foundation is this appeal to positive evidence, and what a fixed type of certitude it produces. I could quote the case of a man for whom I have the highest respect, one of the best living writers of the English language, who was frankly and openly an atheist and materialist till he was quite elderly, and who, being a very sincere man, made no concealment of his philosophy. He denied the survival of the soul and even the existence of God. This man, by his own testimony, and he would be the last person to affirm anything he believed to be false, heard at a seance the voice and, if I remember rightly, saw the face as well of someone he had deeply loved and who was dead. He bore witness to this sight and hearing to myself and to the world. This man I have personally known and shall always revere. Note further that all those who support spiritualism talk in the same fashion. We have a prominent popular writer of fiction, a great physicist, and many other names drawn from every kind of intellectual pursuit, repeating with passionate earnestness that the thing is proved, that those who deny it are willfully refusing to examine plain testimony, and that anyone who will impartially do so will be convinced. Now it may be contended that none of the phenomena, for which there is indeed a great body of testimony, have necessarily the character claimed for them. Many, for instance, the mentioning by a medium of things only known to one of those present may be explained by what is a certainly proved fact and established though abnormal and seemingly not of this world telepathy. Others, for instance, the seeing of a face or the hearing of a voice may be set down to illusion. But it seems to be the general agreement of those who have gone deeply into the matter, and not less of those who abhor spiritualism than of those who revere it, that there is, when all is explained, trickery, illusion and the rest of it, a certain balance of what we should call transcendental experience. You may meet many a man and woman, in the case of the one I quoted, people who have become convinced of what are called the truth of spiritualism after having been, like most of us, contemptuously skeptical. But the other process, the man who has believed in it and lost faith, is perhaps unknown, or at any rate very rare. Here then, I say, is the first mark of the thing, the strength of its conviction. There is a great deal of tomfoolery about it, the spirits of the dead drinking whiskey and smoking cigars, talking base journalese, playing silly little tricks and practical jokes. But when all this is allowed for, some real experience does remain, and on that real experience is based the intense conviction of which I have spoken. Now there is a second mark in connection with spiritualism which renders it a considerable opponent, and it is a mark not usually recognized, its venerable lineage. The thing, though of today in its existing form, is in essence as old as human record. It is one with witchcraft, necromancy, magic. What seems novel in it to us, only so seems novel because it has come after a period of rationalism. The average educated man of the 19th century thought that all the talk of all the centuries about witchcraft and demonology and the rest was too absurd to be worth noticing. He laughed it out of court, but his view was not a sound one historically. Whether such phenomena have occurred in the past is a matter to debate upon the evidence, but that mankind, in the overwhelming mass of its extension in time and in space, that is, over much the greater part of the world and over much the greater part of its recorded history, has believed that such things go on, cannot be denied. The fact that this very new religion is also nothing but a resurrection of a very old one, adds to its strength and to the seriousness with which we must regard it. Catholic doctrine upon the matter is well known. All such investigation is forbidden as an immoral act. It is either plain with falsehood, or if there be, or where there be reality in it, it is of evil origin. We do not communicate with the blessed dead save in those very rare experiences which God may grant to a very few as visions. If we communicate with spirits of another world at will, summoning them regularly for our purposes, the spirits with which we are dealing are evil spirits. That is the teaching of the Church on this matter from the beginning to this our day. We know it may be said in passing that its votaries are sometimes driven mad, sometimes exhibit all the phenomena of possession, and that even its strictest supporters admit these practices to be perilous and only to be engaged in cautiously. Everyone who has read that striking book by the late Father Hugh Benson, The Necromancers, will remember the true drawing of the sincere medium and that medium's admission of the peril which his creed and practice involved. There, then, are the two main features so far as I can analyze them of this strange new sect: one, the quality of its certitude based, not upon emotion, but upon experiment, to the very deep roots in the human past from which it springs, the antiquity of the doctrine and practice of which it is but the resurrection. Yet it has not in it the seed of a great new religion, and the reason should be plain. It enjoys advantages common to all research, it has experiment and evidence to work on, but it suffers the corresponding disadvantages. It has nothing of revelation in it, no unity of philosophy, no general reply to the great questions, and therefore no authority. It takes on no body, it has no organization. That it will persist I believe, that it will grow is probable, that it will become a church is not possible, for it is not made of the stuff of universality out of which great organisms arise. Where then shall we look for the seed of a new religion? I should reply, tentatively, in this, the satisfaction of that messianic mood with which, paradoxically, the despair of the new paganism is shot. The expectation of better things, the confident expectation of their advent, affects the vileness and folly of our time everywhere. Let an individual appear with the capacity or chance to crystallize these hopes and the enemy will have arrived, for Antichrist will be a man. 6. The opportunity. The new paganism advances over the modern world like a blight over a harvest. You may see it in building, in drawing in letters, in morals. But it seems as yet to be producing no positive force. It is breeding no new organized religion to combat the faith. That may come meanwhile. There is a gap, and that gap is our opportunity. It is possible to reconvert the world. What weapons can Catholicism discover wherewith to reconquer from paganism the advance which it shall have made in our culture? This opportunity presented to Catholicism has two aspects. The first is, that paganism being of its nature a confessed inability to answer the great questions on man's ain't nature and destiny is of its nature an invitation to those who possess the key. The second is that we are dealing, not with a paganism native to those we have to meet, but with a paganism which is a corruption of, and decline from, a much better state of society, some memory of which remains, and the corruption of which may soon prove sufficiently shocking to provoke reaction. We are still dealing with Christendom, with Christendom in ruins, but with Christendom. Our fathers aid us. Aid to the first, our unique power to answer the great questions. It has always seemed to me the most powerful instrument possessed by the faith in the spiritual crisis now so close upon us. You cannot perhaps convert despair when despair has been erected into a system, as it has in the greater part of Asiatic paganism, but you can check it in its beginnings, when it is no more than the loss of something which the despairing man knows he has enjoyed, and cannot but wish he might recover. To the great questions which man must ask himself and which so insistently demand an answer: what is man? Whence comes he? Has the universe a purpose? What part does man play in that purpose? What final destinies may be his? The Catholic Church gives not only a reply, Buddhism does that after a fashion, and even in a very vague manner other paganisms less systematized, but a fully consistent solution, a sound, complete, system of philosophy. Moreover, her answer is not only consistent, it is triumphant. She knows fully her own validity. She can point in actual practice to the effect of happiness produced in society by her philosophy. Those great questions will be asked again and again. We are not hearing the last of them. We are rather at the beginnings of their second postulation, at the beginnings of a new interest in them. It is a strange mark of the new paganism, and the most hopeful one, that it should already have become occupied, with discussion at least, on the problem of man. But the greater part of our neo-pagans remain throughout the discussion in ignorance of what the Catholic scheme may be. The success or failure of our effort against the new paganism will depend much more on letting people know what the Catholic Church is, than upon anything else. It is arresting to discover in what numbers modern men with a reasonable standard of instruction in the rest of the world about them are blank upon the most important subject of all, though it lies everywhere right to their hand. They have not the ABC of the faith. Here in England, where I am writing these lines, not a day passes but someone, often of eminence, starts a theological controversy in the popular press, makes an affirmation, one way or the other, upon the great questions, and proposes an answer. But in the whole mass of the stuff, and there are thousands of columns of it, there is not one hundredth which shows the least acquaintance with what the Catholic Church may be. The Catholic theology and its 2,000 years of accumulated definition and reason, the philosophy which made our civilization and in the absence of which our civilization may perish. Thus an Anglican bishop, Dr. Barnes of Birmingham, a man distinguished in his university, a very clear writer and, one would have said, compelled by his very profession to read some theology, told us his reasons the other day for denying the Catholic doctrine of the resurrection. He said it was incompatible with chemistry. Evidently he had no idea what the Catholic doctrine might be. Sir Oliver Lodge, a physicist, produced somewhat earlier a strong affirmation of the future life. It turned out to be this life, much as it is lived in the clubs and hotels of his acquaintance. He has never heard, apparently, the Catholic doctrine of eternity, nor the implications of that doctrine, nor so much as an echo of the profound speculations, the profounder conclusions which contemplation of Catholic dogma has reached in that awful affair. These are two typical examples from England. Of course, things are better on the continent of Europe, where there is some acquaintance with scholastic philosophy even among the opponents of the Catholic Church. But everywhere the chief need is instruction, and our greatest weakness in the conflict which has begun is the difficulty of getting our opponents to know the mere nature of the subject they are so ready to discuss. The second opportunity we have is of a different sort, not intellectual but moral. The falling of Christendom into paganism must necessarily produce results shocking to our inherited culture. Of this reaction there are already signs, but how far will it be pushed? Left to itself, that reaction will effect little. The more hopeful Catholic is encouraged when he sees the disgust already provoked by the first products of the new paganism. He notes the appeal still presented by traditional morals, by the desire to save beauty and proportion and decent living. The less hopeful Catholic notes the vast and increasing proportion of the world about him in which such disgust is not aroused, on which the worst innovations meet with no protest, though commonly, it is true, with no welcome. He sees the continued progress of slime and the gradual or rapid swamping of province after province in our ancient culture. How far their reaction may go, whether we may not even be able to lead it to a triumphant conclusion, no man can tell. I cannot but wish somewhat mercilessly that the new paganism may develop a little too rapidly, shock a little too violently the dormant conscience of Europe, and thereby prepare the counterattack against it. Our world finds itself moving towards nothingness. Can it remain content in the prospect of such a goal? All the old goals have disappeared. Civil liberty has not done what was asked of it. It has not even been achieved. Its concomitant, so-called democracy, has not done what was asked of it. It has not given men dignity or security. Both these great ideals of the 19th century are ending in mere plutocracy and in our subjection to a few quite unworthy controllers of all our lives, the monopolists of material, of currency, information and transport, the tyranny of trust masters in production, banking, journals and communications. The lay philosophies have gone. They have all broken down. They are no longer in effect. They fulfilled no ultimate function. They solved no problem. They brought no peace. Their power has departed. Even the noble religion of nationalism has only brought us to the mutual self-destruction of the great war and threat of much worse, and nationalism itself is growing weary. It made its supreme effort in compelling men to muster for the huge slaughter. It will hardly so muster them again. The void which I thus indicate is not only negative, it creates what engineers call a potential, just as a void in nature creates a potential. For a void must be filled, therefore the emptiness of the present moment, and its unrest, have a certain most important, positive effect, and that is the opportunity. We live not only in a moment of confusion, disappointment and anger, but also in a moment of opportunity for the faith. I have discussed in the last section what signs there might be of new counter-religions arising against the faith and said that, as yet, none appeared. I said also that though not certain yet such a creation was probable. I add here that in its delay is the opportunity for the faith to take the initiative again after its long siege of 300 years. Some solution, as we saw in the discussion of new arrivals, will presumably be attempted, some creed, some social philosophy in which men can rest, nor will the process perhaps be very long delayed. Mankind of our sort seems unlikely to carry on for long without certitude, real or imaginary. Our minds need something on which to bite and should sooner or later, and sooner rather than later, erect doctrines of which tradition will make an unshaken system. Men should adopt not only conventions of conduct, but a code of morals. They should discover or invent something to worship. We of the faith can present them something real to discover, which, when they have found it, will destroy any desire to invent. Such is the nature of the opportunity, and it is of deep interest. Perhaps there has never been an occasion in history when interest of the same kind was present in the same degree. Perhaps it is more than an opportunity. Perhaps action has already begun. The men of a particular period are not aware of the forces that arise in their day. Men in the mass appreciate a force when it is mature and when its action has begun to produce effects upon a large scale. When it is nascent, its presence goes either unnoticed or despised. There is present today throughout the civilization of Europe and its expansion over the New World, a force of this kind. It is the recovery of the Catholic apologetic. It is curious to note that the power of this new influence is more readily recognized by the opponents of the Catholic Church than by its friends. These last are too much aware of the old anti-Catholic fashion in history and literature. They exaggerate its survival and are timid. On the top of that, there is the desire not to disturb. What is worse, the very philosophy of our opponents has tinctured our supporters. Among the less cultivated, the connection between religion and its secondary social effects is unfamiliar. Among the somewhat more cultivated, there is the fear of disturbing superficial worldly relations. Even in the highest rank of intelligence and sincerity, there has grown up a sort of habit in accepting insult, and of this inertia which inhibits the Catholic from doing freely what his opponents do freely. Yet the Catholic apologetic grows. This new force, the modern Catholic apologetic, is fought shy of, even by those in whose favor it is working. But to convince yourself of its existence, note two things: the rapidity with which its opponents have discovered its presence, and the change in general tone now running like a tide through the thought of our time. A new antagonism to the new force of the Catholic Church shows itself in nations of Protestant culture by a certain note of exasperation which in the day of our fathers was unknown. There was plenty of active opposition and bludgeoning of the Church in mid-Victorian days, but it was a contemptuous and assured anger. That of today is panicky. In nations of the Catholic culture, the ill-at-ease Catholic advance shows itself in a sort of sullen muttering among our opponents, the complaint of an old cause which thinks its success a matter of right but no longer certain. If we turn to the positive evidences of this Catholic advance, we shall discover these only after a very general fashion. The characteristically modern test of numbers fails. We are not as yet rapidly advancing in numbers, but the numerical test does not apply at first to a rising moral force. A modern man accustomed to testing everything by numbers would, if he had been put down in Rome about the year 280, have decided that the Catholic Church had no chance, but he would have been quite wrong. In numbers, I repeat, the Catholic Church is not advancing appreciably in the modern world. I think that on the whole, in mere numbers, she is slightly receding. Great peasant areas in France have been lost, and in all Catholic countries great numbers of the new working-class suburbs of the towns have been lost, and these losses more than compensate, on a mere counting of heads, for the new recruitment among the thinkers. In Ireland there may now be some increase over 20 years ago. especially since the stoppage of emigration after 1914. I have no statistics by me as I write, but certainly, compared with a lifetime ago, the figures are against the faith even there. Whether they be so in Great Britain or no, I cannot tell, nor can anyone else, for there is no satisfactory record, but I doubt whether the increase through conversion and the bringing up of the children of mixed marriages has either compensated for the leakage or proved equivalent to the general increase of the population. Here I am subject to correction by many good observers who will disagree with me, but, at any rate, their margin of disagreement will not be very wide. In Italy and Spain, where the position has been firm now for many years, there have been lost throughout generations, and especially latterly, great bodies of artisans in the new industrialism. The bulk of the Germans have been subjected for a long lifetime to an anti-Catholic hegemony. In certain Slav states, notably in Bohemia, nationalism lost, or weakened, Catholic numbers. But the more important intellectual and moral tests of the advance are all in our favor. To begin with, the Catholic case has got over the footlights. It has pierced. Intellectual Europe today is again aware of the one consistent philosophy upon this earth which explains our little passage through the daylight, which gives a purpose to things and which presents not a mere hodgepodge of stories and unfounded assertions, but a whole chain and body of cause and effect in the moral world. It is further becoming apparent that there is, as yet, no rival in this respect to the Catholic Church. There is now no full alternative system left, of perhaps more effect in a time such as ours. After so long a prevalence of intellectual decline, is the pragmatic test of the faith, that is, its test in practice, for practice and experience affect even those who cannot think. It has become more and more clear in the last generation, and with particular acceleration since the latest and immense catastrophe of the Great War, that the faith preserves whatever, outside the faith, is crumbling: marriage, the family, property, authority, honor to parents, right reason, even the arts. This is a political fact, not a theory. It is a fact as large and as certain as is a neighboring mountain in a landscape. If the influence of the church declines, civilization will decline with it and all the effects of tradition. It is a commonplace with educated men that the Catholic Church made our civilization. But it is not equally a commonplace as it ought to be that on her continued power depends the continuance of our civilization. Our civilization is as much a product of the Catholic Church as the vine is the product of a particular climate. Take the vine to another climate and it will die. It is error to mistake this product of the Catholic Church, civilization, for her true end and nature. Her nature is that of an infallible and divine voice. Her end is beatitude elsewhere for us all, who here are exiles. But my point is that all men should closely watch the fortunes of the faith, both those who accept it and those who reject it, because that fortune is bound up with all those lesser things which even those who reject the church regard as essential to right living, from the lesser arts and amenities to the main institutions of European society. Those who defend and support the church, though believing it to be but a man-made delusion because it happens to be the support of a temporal structure, are in grave moral and theological error. The faith is not to be supported on such grounds. My thesis is not of that kind, God forbid, exclamation, but rather that all men, believing or unbelieving, should fix their close attention, at this moment of revolution and transition, upon the Catholic Church, as being the pivotal institution whereupon the fate, even temporal, of all must turn. Two things still partly mask the truth: chaotic and feverish industrialism and the idea that tradition can be destroyed and yet life remain. For the second, I would say that those who maintain it do not understand the nature of life, of maturity, of a fixed organism from which if you take away its vital principle the whole decays. While as to the first, industrialism, I should say that it has lived its odd diseased life strangely and suddenly expanding, but without sufficient happiness by what it retains of Catholic doctrine. Insofar as industrialism and its bad commercial morals have lived with any health, and health is not their conspicuous feature, that non-Catholic culture has hitherto lived by retaining some sense of moral responsibility, and I might add, however distantly, of the incarnation of the incarnation saint effect, at least, upon human dignity. It has survived on ideas inherited from a better time. Moreover, today the non-Catholic culture is manifestly failing, and its only issue is towards nothingness even more among its pagan rich than among its now rebellious poor. I apprehend that in the near future there will arise grave difficulties from the very fact that the tide of the faith is rising. Those engaged upon helping on that tide will confuse faith with fads, for this parallel recognition of authority is the first and indeed the only safeguard. Moreover, we have no doubt where authority lies, and therein we are singularly fortunate, for we act under obedience to a society of divine foundation, of known and definable organs for its expression, and of infallibility in its final decisions. And upon the right conduct of our passage through such perils, how much depends. Upon the right conduct of the presentation of the faith in the next long lifetime surely depends the future of the world. There would seem to be no third event between two issues. Either we shall see the gradual permeation of mankind by the only body of truth to which the mind leaps in unison, rendering all as secure as it can be among the fallen race, or our civilization will sink to be a completely alien body, knowing even less of the faith than do the distraught town millions of today. It would seem as though, before the youngest of our children has passed, the world will have had to take its decision between these two alternatives: either the spreading of the faith throughout the now closely intercommunicating body of mankind, or the splitting of that vast association into two camps, one small, and perhaps dwindling, of the fold, the other large, perhaps growing larger, upon the hills without. Not a few profound observers, one in especial, a modern French Jewish convert of the highest intellectual power, have proposed, as a probable tendency or goal to which we were moving, a world in which a small but intense body of the faith should stand apart in an increasing flood of paganism. I, for my part, it is but a personal opinion and worth little belief, upon the whole, a Catholic increased to be the more likely, for, in spite of the time in which I live, I cannot believe that the human reason will permanently lose its power. Now the faith is based upon reason, and everywhere outside the faith the decline of reason is apparent. But if I be asked what sign we may look for to show that the advance of the faith is at hand, I would answer by a word the modern world has forgotten: persecution. When that shall once more be at work, it will be mourning.